Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Are They Overpaid? Pantry CEO Dennis Hatchell is among the Triangle's most overcompensated CEOs based on metrics such as revenue growth and shareholder return. And that is an article in a section called The List, and it's the list of CEOs and their pay. And the headline is on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Over or underpaid, 1 year, seven companies, seven CEOs, $22,234,604. How much is too much? Wages, performance, vary widely among Triangle CEOs. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. In an office in Cary, Dennis Hatchell, the CEO of convenience store Behemoth, The Pantry Incorporated, since 2012, is dealing with board changes, supplier contracts, and industry challenges, the typical day-to-day activities of helming a company with more than 1,500 stores in 13 states. But at a total compensation of $2.37 million, he's being overpaid to do his job. As was former LipoScience CEO Richard Breyer, Martin Marietta CEO Ward Nye, and even Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst. That's the take of a Triangle Business Journal analysis based primarily on metrics such as revenue, sales growth, and shareholder return. But, as with many publicly traded companies, Hatchell's salary is set based on compensation of peer CEOs, executives leading companies such as Big Lots, Dollar General Corporation, and Dick's Sporting Goods. It's called competitive benchmarking, and that, experts say, is the crux of the problem. It externalizes pay structure and takes away from the overall performance of the organization, says Charles Elson, director of the John L. Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. If you're always being compared with someone else, your board will always target the 50th percent or higher. In 2013, the national CEO to worker pay ratio was 331 to 1, with a CEO to minimum wage worker pay ratio of 774 to 1. According to National Trade Union Center, American Federation of Labor, and Congress of Industrial Organizations, that same year, an analysis of S&P 500 CEOs showed the average total compensation was $11.7 million. When AFL-CIO isolates North Carolina, it finds S&P CEOs here make 268 to 1, when compared to an average worker's salary, and the gap is widening. A recent report from data firm Equilar finds that the 50 top-paid CEOs nationwide saw a 21.7% increase in median compensation last year. In comparison, the Triangle's public company CEOs' cumulative total compensation increased 17% in 2013 from the previous year. From 1978 to 2012, CEO compensation rose 875%. Compare that to an average worker's raise of 5.4% over the same time period, according to the Economic Policy Institute. James McRitchie, publisher of CoreGov.net, that's CoreGov.net, agrees pay is often set above the average of the relevant peer group. He calls it the Lake Wobegon effect, after radio show storyteller Garrison Keillor's fictional town, where all children are above average. Few firms admit to having average executives, he says. While the Lake Wobegon effect may be nice in fictional towns, it doesn't work well for society to have all CEOs considered above average, with their collective pay spiraling out of control. We need to slow the pace of money going to the 1% if our economy is not to become the third world. But executives, however, fear that if they're not offering a more attractive salary than their peers, they won't be able to attract that top-tier talent. The Pantry, which has compensations targeted between the 25th and 50th percentiles, according to a proxy statement, says its competitive stance is sufficient to attract, retain, and motivate executives. Its commonality echoed by proxies at LipoScience, Martin Marietta, and Red Hat. Officials at the pantry declined to comment for this story. But Elson says the facts show that competitive stance is irrelevant because a CEO, competitively salaried or otherwise, isn't going anywhere, he says. CEO skills are really much more company-specific, he says. It's an assumption based on several studies, such as one evaluating data from 1993 to 2009, that found that less than 5% of new CEOs had previously been CEOs at other firms. In a sample of 1,200 CEO changes between 1990 and 1998, 27% were outside hires, but only 4% had jumped immediately from an old employer to a new employer. A significant size differential is required to justify a CEO raid, he explains. In other words, they'd have to get an offer from a much larger company. The numbers show that rarely happens. It's a completely false assumption held by boards, he says. While performance is usually factored into the payout, as it is for the top four CEOs mentioned, even that scale is based on what peer companies are doing. In setting performance goals and measuring performance against these goals, we use a performance management process and evaluate our pay practices relative to those at companies in our industry that we consider to be our peers, Red Hat's proxy reads, repeating a common reasoning that the current structure, which aims for about the 25th percentile, will allow it to compete for and retain top talent. Its peers include the likes of NetApp, Citrix Systems, and Adobe Systems. But Brian Balbirnie, CEO of Morrisville-based Issuer Direct, defends the peer group compensation program, even though his firm doesn't use that algorithm. Under TBJ's metrics, Balbirnie's total compensation of $140,753 makes him the triangle's most underpaid CEO. He says compensation plans should be created on a case-by-case basis. If the company is a cornerstone established entity, has been around for 50 years or 100 years, a large cap company, I think you have to do peer review, he says. If it's a merging space, it's based on the need of the company and the demands of the company at the time, and that's where we fall in. He points to some big differences between his firm and one at the other end of the spectrum, Red Hat. It's all relative to the type and size of the company, he says, mentioning Red Hat's $10 billion market cap compared to his company's about $20 million. His company looked at a peer comparison determination, but found that peers weren't comparable in size. Balbirnie, so that we could have a good bonus structure, elected to take his compensation on the tail end with a 25% ownership interest. That and a performance-based algorithm keeps him true to the company, he says. But Elson says the performance component isn't enough. He recommends that companies promote from within, adding that it's cheaper than going outside the building, and the executive will have built-in expertise for the of the company's operation. Peer compensation, he says, should be used as a sanity check. And along with this article, there's also, listing of information, headlined Over Underpaid, Few Women CEOs on the Highest Paid List. Out of all the public company CEOs in the triangle, there are only three women. Here's a closer look at those leaders. Carolyn Logan, company Salix Pharmaceuticals, CEO since July 2002. Previous position, Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Salix from 2000 to 2002. Prior to joining Salix, Logan served as Vice President of Sales and Marketing of the Oclassen Dermatologics Division of Watson Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. And also, Prabhavathi Fernandez, company Sempra Incorporated, CEO since January 2006, previous position, President and CEO of Dar Pharma. She has also served as President and CEO of Recerca Biosciences and Small Molecular Therapeutics. And finally, Dr. June Almanoff, company Furiex Pharmaceuticals, President since June 2010, previous position. Almanoff joined Furiex after a 12-year career at GlaxoSmithKline. She served as vice president in the Clinical Safety and Pharmacovigilance Organization at GSK. And under that, most overpaid CEO, here's a brief glimpse into the world of Dennis Hatchell, CEO of The Pantry and the company he leads. Total 2013 compensation, $2.37 million. Total 2013 salary, $762,981. CEO since March 2012. Type of company, convenience store chain. Pantry revenue growth decrease in 2013 from 2012, -5%. Company performance versus peer group, 45% below. Company earnings momentum performance, -0.006. Company 2013 revenue, $7.8 billion. And the most underpaid CEO. Here's a brief glimpse into the world of Brian Balbirnie, CEO of Issuer Direct Corporation and the company he leads. Total 2013 compensation, $140,753. Total 2013 salary, $140,753. CEO since 2006, Balbirnie is the founder of the company. Type of company, developer of disclosure management and targeted communications. Issuer Direct Corporation revenue growth increase in 2013 from 2012, 105%. Company performance versus peer group, 174% above. Company earnings momentum growth, 7.5%. And company 2013 revenue, $8.8 million. And there's also a short article headlined, "The Methodology Behind the CEO Compensation Analysis." Triangle Business Journal evaluated the 2013 compensation of the Triangle's public company CEOs in relation to the performance of each CEO's company. For the performance portion of the pay performance link, TBJ ranked the Triangle's largest by revenue public companies in four areas: revenue growth, total return to shareholders versus a peer group, growth in earnings as scaled by revenue, a figure that we call earnings momentum, and total revenue. Finally, the sums of those four ranks were themselves ranked to determine overall company performance. The stock measure looks at each company's shareholder return during the fiscal year as compared to an index of similar companies over that same period. The default peer group for companies without a 10K chart is the S&P 500. Earnings momentum. In those cases where companies lost money in the prior year, a simple percentage change in earnings is not mathematically sound. Therefore, we rank the year-over-year change in earnings as a percentage of prior year revenue, allowing the study to include all companies. Our emphasis on growth is intentional. We want to downgrade CEOs who are simply stewards of an ongoing enterprise and reward those who are actively seeking to build their companies. Performance statistics were generated by data gathered by our research department from company 10Ks and year-end financial releases. Stock price sources include Yahoo Finance. Those CEOs with a disparity between their own high rank and total compensation and the low rank of their company's financial performance are considered overpaid. Conversely, those CEOs who rank low in compensation and high in performance are considered underpaid. Those CEOs who place in the middle of the spectrum are deemed appropriately paid. In putting lines of demarcation in, we place the overpaid line at +5. In doing so, 7 CEOs are overpaid. The underpaid line sits at -9, where the biggest break occurs, giving us 6 underpaid CEOs. Companies that filed for the public markets during 2014 were not included on this list. Companies that had revenue of less than $5 million were also not included in the overpaid-underpaid CEOs calculation. And in a by-the-numbers section, $73.92 million, the cumulative amount of 2013 total compensation of CEOs of publicly traded companies in the Triangle, and 63.5 $12 million. The cumulative amount of 2012 total compensation of CEOs of publicly traded companies in the triangle. And note, this number excludes two CEOs from the 2013 count whose total compensation figures were not available. And in another section, we have headlined Salary Stack, the triangle's top CEO salaries. Here's how the top four local public company CEOs stack up, according to 2013 salary figures. Tom Pike of Quintiles, $1.3 million. He was in the appropriately paid column. Frank Holding Jr., First Citizens Bank, $944,000. Ward Nye, Martin Marietta, $875,000. And Carolyn Logan of Salix, $867,000. And finally, we'll give the list of the companies. The ones considered overpaid, with overpaid CEOs, The Pantry, Martin Marietta Materials, Red Hat Incorporated, Ply Gem, Lipo Science, Alliance One, and Triangle Capital. Appropriately paid includes Power Secure, Sempra, Quintiles, Highwoods Properties, Salix Pharmaceuticals, BioDelivery Sciences, SciQuest, First Citizens Bank, Xerium Technologies, Stock Building Supply, Cree, BioChrist, New Century Bancor, Posen, and Charles and Colvard. And the underpaid list includes Vantage South, Investors Title, Four Oaks Fincor, Channel Advisor, FuryX, and Issuer Direct. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings in the Triangle Business Journal. This is written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Lawyering can be spooky at times. In lending his expertise to TBJ's largest bankruptcies list last week, bankruptcy attorney Richard Sparkman took the chance to reflect one of his most memorable cases. He recalls being a Chapter 7 trustee for a Raleigh hotel. The hotel closed, and rather than clean things up, hotel management threw a pool party, and then everyone disappeared, he says. Sparkman himself helped clean up the hotel. Doing security checks by walking through that enormous facility at night with no power, I expected a little kid on a tricycle chanting red rum to come pedaling around the corner at any moment, he says. But all worked out well in the end. Sparkman says the hotel was eventually sold to Providence Baptist Church for its full appraised value. Rex Open on the move. Looks like the 2015 edition of the Rex Hospital Open Golf Tournament may have a new venue next year. Talks are underway to host the web.com tour stop at the Lonnie Pool Golf Course in Raleigh next year. Until now, the tournament was held at the TPC at Wakefield Plantation Golf Course in North Raleigh. John McConnell, owner of McConnell Golf, which owns the Wakefield Golf Course, told Biz that the company was losing some $40,000 to $50,000 to host the tourney. All we want is to come in break even, McConnell said. Biz wanted to talk to Dan Adams, vice president of Campus Enterprises at North Carolina State University, that oversees the Lonnie Pool golf operation, but did not get a call back. Keeping the Rex Hospital open at TPC Wakefield is still very much an option, says Rex spokesman Alan Wolf. We are reviewing all of our options for the Triangle's top charity golf tournament and hope to have a decision soon. In anticipation of hosting the event, the Lonnie Pool course is undergoing a massive renovation of its bunkers. The Rex Hospital Open is part of the web.com tour that showcases players competing to earn their PGA Tour cards. Will Pat run for president? North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory recently spoke with Fox Business Network about the improvements in North Carolina's debt and the unemployment rate, as well as possibly running for president of the United States. Asked about the unemployment rate, McCrory said, Our data is starting to tell us that people are taking jobs. In addition, we're bringing new jobs to North Carolina. And that, we are recruiting new jobs, existing jobs are expanding, and people are taking the jobs being offered. As for a possible run for president, he said, well, I like being governor of North Carolina. Family time at the baseball park. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Brad Wilson will make a trip to Wrigley Field this weekend with his son, Alex Wilson. The Atlanta Braves are Alex's favorite team, and the Wilson men, Brad and his wife, Carol, also have a married daughter, Ann Kratz, have made it a birthday tradition to visit the Braves during a road trip around this time of year. That way, they get to see the Braves while experiencing a new stadium. Brad says the tradition has been going strong with only a very few exceptions since Alex's 11th birthday, which is impressive since this year he turned 28. Nonprofit wins cash and Google Glass. A Lumberton charity is about to get high-tech. 3,000 Miles to a Cure is one of five charities selected out of 1,300 proposals to Google. The prize? Google Glass and $25,000. Specifically, the proposals were about how the organizations could use Google Glass to enhance their networks. 3,000 Miles to a Cure plans to use the Google Glass technology to deliver riders participating in a bicycle race for charity. And now we turn to the reporter pages. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on her main story, Marriott coming to NCSU, Hotel Conference Center planned for Centennial Campus. For nearly two decades now, NC State University has been wishing for a hotel and conference center for its Centennial Campus in Raleigh, a place where it could attract regional, national, and international conferences related to education, science, and technology. UNC Chapel Hill has its historic Carolina Inn. Duke University has the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club to accommodate visiting alumni and corporate partners. NC State, though, has no official affiliation with a local hotel group, and its only real option for corporate events on campus is the McKimmon Conference and Training Center that opened in 1976. Former NC State Chancellor Mary Ann Fox even tried to push through a proposal in 2002 to build a hotel project on Centennial Campus using university bond funds. However, opposition from nearby hotel operators who would be competing with the university for that business forced her to abandon those plans. But plans are now coming together to break ground on a $28 million Marriott-affiliated hotel and conference center complex next spring, with an expected opening date in spring 2016. The project, slated for 10 acres on a site overlooking Lake Raleigh near the Park Alumni Center and the Lonnie Pool Golf Course, will be privately funded and developed by a partnership between Concord Eastridge Incorporated of Arlington, Virginia, and Noble Investment Group of Atlanta. BB&T is providing debt financing for the project. The new hotel will operate under the Marriott Autograph Collection franchise, which is a fairly new affiliation program launched in 2010 that allows select independent hotels to tap into Marriott's global sales, reservations, and reward system. In North Carolina, the Marriott Autograph Collection counts the Siena Hotel in Chapel Hill, a AAA Four Diamond Hotel, and the Grand Bohemian Hotel in Asheville among its members. The yet-to-be-named hotel at Centennial Campus will also open with 155 rooms and 7,500 square feet of meeting space, with the potential to expand later with an additional 75 rooms and 7,500 square feet of meeting space. The plans are so new, in fact, they don't even have architectural renderings yet. We're just now starting the redesign, says Mike Haller, Senior Vice President of Concord Eastridge. An affiliation with the upscale Marriott Autograph Collection franchise will also give the developers more options in customizing the design of the buildings, he says, to better reflect the NC State brand. And a few short stories. Restaurant to open at Carrie's historic Jones House. A new farm-to-table restaurant called Bell will be opening soon in the historic Jones House in downtown Cary. The Carytown government owns the building and is close to finishing renovations needed for an August opening. Cary's town government bought the 2,000-square-foot house in 2011 and has invested $255,000 to revitalize the site. 111 Seaboard sold for $4.6 million. The former state government building at 111 Seaboard in downtown Raleigh, that was transformed into a multi-tenant retail building in 2013, has been sold. The developers of 111 Seaboard, a joint venture project between York Properties of Raleigh and Shiner Capital Partners LLC of Chicago, Illinois, have sold the building for $4.6 million. The buyer of the building was an entity called 44 Walker LLC, which is owned by investor Maurice Danny Danilian of Port St. Lucie, Florida. Charles Schwab to build glass office near Crabtree Valley Mall. Demolition crews are cleaning up the remains of the Shell gas service station, recently torn down on Glenwood Avenue in front of Crabtree Valley Mall, and a new office building for the Charles Schwab Financial Services firm is being planned in its place. The 5,200-square-foot building will have floating glass walls and landscaped terrace walls in front. The building is expected to be completed in April 2015. Mall GM resigns. The general manager of Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh has resigned to pursue a new gig in Texas with a competitor mall company. Jack Love, who helped open the mall in 2002 and returned in 2007 to take over as GM, was recently named general manager of Town East Mall in Mesquite, Texas. The Texas Mall is owned by General Growth Properties, which also owns the streets at South Point Mall in Durham. Love previously spent 13 years working for Chattanooga, Tennessee-based CBL & Associates Properties, which owns both Triangle Town Center and Cary Town Center malls in Wake County. Love says he left CBL on his own to pursue opportunities that were closer to his family living in Texas. We enjoyed our time in Raleigh, making lifelong friends, but we wanted to be near aging parents, he wrote in an email message. A new mall general manager is expected to be named soon, and will start work in mid-July. And now we turn to the reporter page of Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The first headline, Posen stock spikes after new FDA filing, heart attack prevention drug closer to approval. After ironing out FDA inspection deficiencies with a drug manufacturer, Chapel Hill pharmaceutical developer Posen resubmitted a new drug application. This application, called NDA for short, is sort of the drug development finish line in which developers submit a packet to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration with information to convince the regulator that the drug company should be allowed to market its product. Posen did this for an aspirin drug in 2013, but the FDA found deficiencies at Posen's third-party manufacturer in April. Now Posen CEO John Placeca says the company completed an audit on the manufacturer, which is not named, and that it is back in FDA compliance, leading to the resubmission of the NDA. Based upon the available information, we believe there are actions in place that address the deficiencies noted by FDA, Placeca said in early July. The announcement sent the stock up more than 10% to nearly $9.59 on July 2nd, very near the 52-week high of $9.90. The share price settled back down to $9 after the 4th of July weekend. The drug applications are for products identified simply as PA-8140 and PA-32540, which are similar but contain different amounts of aspirin. Posen would like to market the drugs for use for the secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease in patients at risk for aspirin-induced gastric ulcers. Aspirin is proven to prevent cardiovascular diseases, but has a side effect of ulcers. Posen has shown that its products reduce the risk of those side effects. For the two PA products in this drug application, Posen has an agreement with drug giant Sanofi U.S., in which Posen is responsible to obtain all regulatory approval for the products, and Sanofi will be responsible for commercialization of the products within the United States. In the deal, Sanofi paid Posen $15 million upfront and would owe Posen pre-commercial milestone payments of $20 million. In addition, Posen would receive tiered royalties of between 12% and 23% on sales within the United States. Posen retained the rights to the PA products outside U.S. markets. Aspirin therapy has become the standard of care for reducing an individual's risk of a second heart attack or stroke. Studies have found that a daily aspirin regimen for people who have experienced a previous heart attack reduces the risk of a second heart attack by about one-third. Aspirin has been incorporated into the American Heart Association's clinical guidelines for the secondary prevention of cardiovascular events, and the group estimates that 24 million Americans should be taking aspirin for secondary prevention of cardiovascular events. Treatment for the secondary prevention of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease typically consists of multiple prescription and over-the-counter drugs, including statins, antihypertensives, and antiplatelet agents. Competition for Posen's PA products will come from the prescription antiplatelet market, including Plavix and generics like Effient and Brilinta. In 2011, prior to loss of market exclusivity, Plavix sales exceeded $9 billion worldwide. However, because over-the-counter aspirin is used to treat many conditions, including pain and inflammation, identifying the portion of sales attributable to antiplatelet therapy is difficult. And the next article in this section, pain drug trial gives BDSI financial boost. There were some fist pumps and high fives at Raleigh drug developer BioDelivery Sciences International. The small drug developer received some of the best news in company history when it announced a drug trial with results showing that its product performed very well compared to a placebo. BioDelivery showed that its drug called bemabuprenorphine, which is being developed for the management of pain severe enough to require daily, around-the-clock, long-term opiate treatment, successfully met its primary efficacy endpoint in demonstrating that the drug resulted in, quote, significantly improved chronic pain relief compared to placebo, unquote, according to the trial results. We are extremely pleased with this robust and significant outcome from this trial in opiate-experienced patients and look forward to sharing more of the results from this study and the positive results from the earlier opiate-naive study at upcoming medical conferences, said Mark Sergo, president and CEO of BDSI. BioDelivery partnered with Dublin-based drug developer Endo Pharmaceuticals, a subsidiary of Endo International. In many ways, Endo can be seen as a lifesaver for BioDelivery. A few years ago, BDSI reported negative trial results, which sent investors scattering. Without money to continue development, Sergo and BioDelivery needed a lifeline, which was provided through a partnership with Endo for bemabuprenorphine. The most recent successful trial results triggered a $10 million payment from Endo to BioDelivery. And now we have a by the numbers section. $5.21 billion. Total revenue generated by the Duke University Health System, ranking it 21st among nonprofit hospitals in the United States, according to data compiled by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, analyzed by American Hospital Directory, and published by Becker's Hospital Review. 300. Employees added by Quintiles when it completed the acquisition of Encore Health Resources. Quintiles provides outsourced research and analysis services to biopharmaceutical and other healthcare companies. Encore services focus on implementation and advisory services around electronic health records, EHR, an area where Quintiles has not given a direct focus. $10 million. Extension of credit line by Chapel Hill drug developer Sempra Pharmaceuticals. It also borrowed $3 million in addition to the credit extension given by Hercules Capital Funding Trust. In late 2011, Sempra initially signed a $20 million loan and security agreement with Hercules. The latest is the Fourth Amendment. $180 million. Grant received by UNC Chapel Hill to study ways to improve health and well-being in developed countries. It was the second largest grant in the university's history. And 60% decrease in market capitalization of drug developer Regado Biosciences, a Duke University spinout, after it said it would pause a clinical trial to review safety data. The drug system being tested is being used in heart surgeries in which a physician mechanically opens or widens obstructed coronary arteries, but was put on hold to review possible side effects from allergic reactions. And finally, in the section titled He Said It, we are in a target-rich, lead-poor environment. Our job is to find those targets that the market covets. We have a high volume of early-stage assets that we partner out. We don't intend to be a fully integrated pharmaceutical company. And that's a quote from Ed Addison of Cloud Therapeutics. Addison, president, CEO, and co-founder of Cloud Therapeutics, which will soon close on $2 million private placements that Addison hopes to parlay into a $20 million infusion from an institutional investor. Scientists at Cloud don't actually work to develop any one drug, but take somewhat of a buckshot approach in identifying the targets. Addison says that today's life sciences industry is good at identifying how one gene or protein might react to a treatment, but struggles at developing leads around that discovery that can lead to drug development. Cloud gathers many of these targets and identifies those leads that are most likely to succeed from a huge pool. Then, instead of developing them on its own, Cloud licenses those leads to a drug developer to run the more standard process of drug development. And now we have the reporter page of Lauren Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. The main headline, Bikini Bus rolls out in Cary. Melanie Pierce launches startup fashion truck. No, that's not a food truck. It's Cary's own Bikini Bus, the brainchild and savings of entrepreneur Melanie Pierce. And just in time for summer, it's trolling Triangle Streets near you, selling jewelry, cover-ups, and of course, bikinis. Pierce let me in on the deluded story behind her startup, a startup she hopes will inspire other fashion truck entrepreneurs enough for a fashion rodeo. It starts in Brazil, where Pierce, who hosted a Brazilian foreign exchange student in 2010, went to vacation for 5 weeks. They actually sell bikinis on the beach, she says. They sell them off of carts, off of poles, so I jokingly told my friends I'd sell bikinis. Why not, she asks. But carts and poles weren't feasible for North Carolina coastal locales such as Wrightsville and Topsail. I said, what if I did it in the back of a van, she says. A little internet exploration showed her it's not an isolated idea. Fashion trucks are a thing in larger metros. It's just new and different to this area, she says. So Pierce, who tells me she wants to be a pioneer in this, got to work, and the bus didn't come without sacrifice. I had sold my house, and I said, I can either buy a new house or buy a bus, she says. I know that sounds really bad, but I bought a bus. Worst case scenario, if I fail, I'll have a bus and a lot of bikinis to sell as stocking stuffers. Primarily, she's selling in the Triangle, though she did just score a big beauty pageant sponsorship that will give her more exposure. And in addition to attending food truck rodeos and festivals, she does private parties. It's basically bikinis and martinis, and they have a good time, she says. By day, she still works as a traffic manager at Sinclair Broadcast Group, supporting 32 television stations in 15 different markets. But by night, it's a totally different channel. I'm really excited about this, she says. It's working. Entrepreneur hopes to market minimalist wallet. By day, he designs packages at plant science firm BASF in Research Triangle Park. By night, he's a wallet entrepreneur, trying to catch what's in your pocket up to the 21st century. Raleigh resident Matt Christie says he's always been kind of fascinated with minimalist wallets and is turning that interest into a startup. Christie's Vertigo wallet has already exceeded his $8,200 goal on Kickstarter. He says you'll pay $48 for the product, which has a spinning mechanism so you can access your credit cards easily. There's a lot of things that are changing, especially in the digital world, he says. The traditional bifold wallet is outdated. People don't use cash as much. They don't keep cash on them. Receipts are being mailed. He says research shows carrying a wallet in your back pocket can lead to back trouble, so he suggests carrying it in the front pocket. And if you're going to have a wallet in your front pocket, you don't want this big bulge, he says. Thus, the minimalist wallet. His interest started with another wallet, one he didn't design, but purchased through Kickstarter from another designer. And that prototype, he says, was disappointing. So he turned to his computer and sent a design to an outside 3D printer. A design that was, he admits, terrible. His wife told him as much. I was really proud of it, too, he laughs, but he quickly saw it her way. I changed my concept drastically. It was way too big and way too bulky. Part of it was the flexible material from the 3D printer and the bulky way the printer handled curves. So for his next prototype, he used outside suppliers and a type of thermoplastic he uses at BASF called Delsin. As a packaging engineer, I work with suppliers and I qualify suppliers, he says. I have packaging specifications that I create for components, so I had a little bit of knowledge. His goal with the oversubscribed round is to place a large order and build inventory, selling the wallets initially through his website. Blazinski teams up for a new gaming company. Cliff Blazinski, the Epic Games veteran behind the Gears of War franchise, is teaming up with Arjun Brucey, founder of Guerrilla Games and Japanese firm Nexon, on an all-new venture to be based in Raleigh. Dubbed Boss Key Productions, it's a company first teased on Twitter. He lets us in on why he chose Raleigh for his latest project. As a resident of the Triangle for 16 years, I've fallen in love with it and learned to call it home. I believe in this area, and downtown Raleigh in particular. Raleigh Technology Center may be revived. The defunct Raleigh Business and Technology Center could get a second wind. It's been a year since city leaders yanked its funding amid an audit that turned up significant finance issues at the center. City leaders recently heard from local thinkers, everyone from IBM veterans to Cisco engineers to entrepreneurs, on ways the incubator could be reinvented. They were all part of a visioning team, says City Chief Information Officer Gail Roper. They met three times to talk about how to utilize the space. Really, the report was around all of the vast opportunities that we can have out of that space, she says, adding that the team didn't arrive at one sole opinion on how to revive the incubator. But the team did talk about ways to broaden the focus, opening the space up to a larger set of entrepreneurs. Since 2000, tenants of the nonprofit had to be minority-owned businesses, but that was then. Anything could happen this time around, Roper says. You may recall $100,000 in unexplained payments led Raleigh police to start investigating the center last year. The center had received more than $160,000 from the city annually and didn't have to pay rent. The city had contracted with the company as a business incubator and provider of other training services. And finally, we have a section, Fireworks by the Numbers. Enjoy the show last week. Cities across the Triangle got lucky as the weather held out for their fireworks shows July 4. Here's a look at how much cash was spent to celebrate Independence Day with a bang. $45,000. The town of Chapel Hill aimed big with its 5,500 shell July 4th show. $30,000. The city of Raleigh shot fireworks from two different locations but didn't foot the bill. Sponsors ABC 11 and Downtown Raleigh Alliance did. $20,000. That's how much the town of Cary paid to shoot 3,640 shells from the Cocobooth Amphitheater. $20,000. The town of Clayton shot 5,431 shells on July 4. $15,000. That's how much the city of Durham paid for fireworks at Durham Bulls Athletic Park, but the actual cost was higher, as 5,000 shells were shot on Independence Day. $15,000. That's how much the town of Wake Forest sank into fireworks July 3rd, but only $5,000 actually came from the town. The rest came from entrance fees and sponsorships. $11,000. That's how much Garner paid for its 1,094 shell show on July 3rd. $10,000. Nightdale's inaugural fireworks show contained more than 500 fireworks. And $5,600. That's how much Morrisville paid to shoot off 840 fireworks. And finally, we have the reporter page of Dawn Curry, who covers small business personalities and triangle trends. Solar shingles not likely to replace solar panel market. While people are getting in line to have solar shingles installed on their homes, traditional solar panels are hardly threatened. So says Dan Lazema, owner of Raleigh-based solar power installation company SunDollar Energy, the first company in the Triangle to install solar shingles on a home. Dow Powerhouse, a division of Dow Chemical Company, makes these shingles. Since bringing the solar shingles to Cary in mid-June, Lazema says he's had plenty of feedback from curious customers. "We have received probably 12 calls of people who wanted to ask about it," he says, "but no sales as of yet. We have 3 projects right now that we are in the sales process with. The feedback I have received is that people love the way they look." These shingles are attractive because they sit flush with the roof, unlike traditional solar panels, because the shingles have to be installed with the roof. "For a customer to be a good candidate for solar shingles, all the stars have to align," says Lazema, one of the Triangle's only certified Dow Powerhouse solar shingle installers. "First, you must need a new roof. The front of the building must face south, and shingles would only be an option if solar panels aren't allowed by the Homeowners Association," Lazema says. "I don't think traditional solar panels are going anywhere, at least for now, as they on a purely price-watt standpoint offer more power per square foot, higher efficiency, and more for your production and money," he says. Materials Center moving to larger Durham space. A Durham-based used materials collection center for artists is moving into a new space in August. The Scrap Exchange, a nonprofit business founded in 1991 that collects reusable materials for art installations and educational events, will be making the 23,000 square feet former Duke Surplus building at Lakewood Shopping Center its new home. According to Margaret McNabb, president of the Exchange Board, the building was purchased for $840,000 in December. The Scrap Exchange accepts donations of used materials that would otherwise head to a landfill, such as fabric, office supplies, candles, picture frames, fake houseplants, sterile and unused lab equipment, and metal hardware. These materials are sold in the Exchange's retail store. "Our collections come from individuals as well as partners like McKinney, SAS, Counterculture, Burt's Bees, Bioagglutinics, NC State, and so on," says McNabb, who adds that the nonprofit has 63 full-time and part-time employees and diverted 70 tons of reusable materials from waste last year. And now we turn to the executive voice in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal, and it features Michelle Sanders. And Michelle Sanders is the highest-ranking executive at Biogen Idec's Research Triangle Park facility. The headline, "Safety First, Then Dancing, Biogen Idec Exec on Leadership, Mentorship, STEM." And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. Large-cap biotechnology company Biogen Idec recently received approval to market both hemophilia A drug, Eloctate, and a hemophilia B drug, Alprolix, both of which will be produced at a facility in Research Triangle Park. Analysts believe Eloctate could reach blockbuster status, something that would give even more clout to Biogen Idec's manufacturing facility in RTP, overseen by Michelle Sanders, the highest-ranking Biogen executive in this area. Sanders took some time to talk with Triangle Business Journal about operations in RTP and also gave a glimpse into her personal life. What keeps you up at night? One thing that keeps me up is the accountability of this role. I'm responsible for general management of this site and head of manufacturing, so first and foremost, I want to ensure that our employees are safe and are in a safe environment. You always have safety risks. Fortunately, we have a culture of safety and have even received an award for it. But safety is very important to me, so there is not a time that it's not on my mind. I'm able to sleep at night because of our safety culture, but it is of utmost concern to me. From an industry perspective, I would say that because I believe our industry will solve the big problems of our world, I'm concerned that the industry will remain sustainable and maintain a sustainable talent pipeline. Will we have the talent that we have today going forward and move forward with breakthrough science? Both personally and professionally, you like to encourage the next generation of scientists, particularly in young girls. Are there still hurdles or stereotypes to overcome for young ladies entering STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math? Investing in STEM is an important area for us here at Biogenetic, and also for me both personally and professionally. I will continue to encourage and hopefully inspire female talent. In my family, I'm probably one of the first ones to encourage family members to ask questions, to be curious. I think it's important for young ladies to understand that they have the capability to enter STEM fields and so much more, anything that anyone else would do. And secondly, to realize that it is a really cool field to be in and to understand what all the possibilities are. Historical stereotypes can go along with perceptions of what it takes to be successful in the science world. That can be frustrating, but it's important to know who you are and be confident and comfortable in your own skin. You like to talk about mentors. Who have your mentors been and how have they affected you? Mentors have meant a lot to me. I've had mentors that offer advice, and I know that's not how I would have done something, but it's good to hear the other perspective. A mentor is really a trusted advisor, a confidant, someone that you can be transparent and open with, and that they have your success as a vested interest of theirs, both personally and professionally. When you were 10 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? A doctor. Even back at that time, I've had an interest in healthcare and serving others. What was your first job? Abrams Barbecue in Belhaven. I was 16 at the time and worked the drive-thru. I later advanced to the catering events. What are your favorite restaurants here in the Triangle? And cuisines. And I also like the Cheesecake Factory. What's your favorite phone app? The one I use the most is probably the bank app to transfer money to my daughters, but I don't want to say that that's my favorite phone app. I use the travel app as I travel a lot. What are some of your hobbies? I love spending time with family and friends. I love entertaining. Being with people gives me energy. Also, I enjoy art and interior design, and shopping is always good. Who is someone that you admire? Michelle Obama. I admire her for who she is, for what I know her to be, for her intelligence, for her leadership, and her stamina. Are you ever frustrated when people call you Michelle as opposed to Michelle? No, I'm accustomed to it, and Michelle, spelled M-A-C-H-E-L-L-E, is actually my middle name. My first name is Andrea, but my parents called me by my middle name. If someone calls me Andrea, it tells me how well that person knows me. What kind of music do you listen to? I like the mix of funk, R&B, old-school hip-hop, music that originated in the mid-60s and 70s in the D.C. area. There's a lot of rhythm to it. I enjoy dancing, or at least believing I do, and I like jazz music because I like all the beat that it has. It can also be relaxing. Here at Biogenetic, I've even leveraged jazz as a metaphor for leadership, as a way to compare cohesive and coherent leadership to a jazz band or jazz music. What's your favorite movie? The Bodyguard with Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston. And I also like comedies. There's so much in the world that is not comedic, so I prefer one that is comical. And now we'll turn to the viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, the editor's notebook. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline on the viewpoint Salix move, bad news for economy, area. On July 8, one of Raleigh's most promising homegrown companies, Salix Pharmaceuticals, announced that it will acquire the Irish arm of Italian pharmaceutical company Cosmo Pharmaceuticals. Sounds good, right? A local company growing not only organically but through acquisition? But wait, there is more. Salix also announced that it will move its headquarters to Ireland for tax purposes. It will reincorporate in Ireland, apply to be listed in NASDAQ, and offer Cosmo shareholders about 20% of the combined company. Why is Salix doing this? CEO Carolyn Logan says the move will save the company millions in taxes. Initial estimates suggest Salix's tax rate will go from the high 30s to the low 20s. Unless I'm missing something here, this is bad for Raleigh and the U.S. In recent months, some Washington lawmakers have been worried about such moves made by U.S. companies simply to shave off their tax liabilities. Politicians have argued that these transactions are simply to avoid paying taxes, when in reality, very little changes operationally. They may have a case. Information services company Experian reported more than $132 billion in deals between U.S. and Irish companies in 2014, up sixfold from last year. In total, there were 147 deals through June of this year. How can that be good for the U.S.? Now to the Raleigh Triangle impact. Salix is one of the most successful companies to come out of this area. The company earned $143 million last year on $984 million revenue. Logan, Chief Financial Officer Adam Derbyshire, and Chief Development Officer William Forbes have been with the company for 10 years or more and have called Raleigh home. The company has been involved with charitable organizations. From what we are told, Logan and her team will continue to call Raleigh home, and Salix will call Raleigh its U.S. headquarters. That's the good news. And the article goes on to say the leadership will stay here, but it wonders how that can be possible with headquarters overseas. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.